I was stiff and sore, bruised of shoulder and across the small of my back, and there was a lump above my temple that was too painful to touch. "Can he walk?" Laren fussed over me. "I can try." It wasn't too painful, and I even found the inclination to photograph the huge dead beast as it knelt in a prayerful attitude, with the head supported on the curved yellow tusks. Laren and the bushman sat on its head. "We will camp tonight at the water in the rocks," Hai told me, "and tomorrow we will return and take the teeth." "How far is it?" I asked dubiously. "Oh, close," Hai assured me, "very close." And I scowled at him uncertainly. I had heard him use the same words to describe a march of 50 miles. "It had bloody well better be," I said in English. And to my surprise, it was much closer than I had expected, and a lot of other things I'd not expected either. We crossed one ridge, with me hobbling along on Lauren's arm, and then came out onto a wide granite sheet, a great curved dome of rock, almost 4 acres in extent. I took one look at it, at the lines of shallow, rounded holes that dimpled the entire surface, and I let out a whoop of joy. Suddenly I no longer needed Lauren's support, and both of us ran down into the stone floor, chortling with glee as we examined the regular lines of worn depressions. "Must have been a big one, Ben," Laren exulted, and he made a guess at the number of holes. "1,000? "Oh, more," I said. "More like 2,000. I paused then, imagining the long regular lines of naked slaves kneeling on the rock floor, each beside one of the smooth depressions, each of them linked to his neighbor by the iron slave chains, each of them with a heavy iron pestle in his hands, pounding away at the gold-bearing ore in the stone mortar between his knees. I saw in my imagination the slave masters walking along the lines, the leather whips in their hands as they checked that the rock was crushed to a fine powder. I saw the endless columns of slaves with ore baskets balanced on their heads coming up from the workings. And all this had happened here nearly 2,000 years before. I wonder where the mine is." Laren was paralleling my thoughts. "And the water," I added. "They need water to wash the gold out." "Oh, the hell with the water," Laren shouted. "It's the mine I want. Those old boys only worked values of 3 ounces and over, and they stopped at water level. There's a bloody treasure house around here somewhere." This was how all the ancient mines had been destroyed. It was a credit to the skill of the ancient metallurgists that the site of nearly every modern mine in Central Africa had been discovered by them 2,000 years before. The modern miners ripped out all trace of the ancient workings in their haste to expose the abandoned reef. I made a vow that at the least I would be first into this one, before the vandals with their drills and dynamite. The water was at the bottom of a 50-foot well, cut cleanly through the living rock, its walls lined with masonry. It was the finest example of an ancient well I'd ever seen. Clearly it had been kept in good repair by the bushman, and I gloated over it, while Hai fetched a rawhide rope and leather bucket from a hiding place among the rocks. He brought the bucket up, brimming with clear water, in which floated a few dead frogs and a drowned bush rat. I made a resolution to boil every drop before it passed my lips. Laren spent a full 30 seconds at admiring the well before he set off into the narrow valley between the two ridges of granite. I watched him disappear amongst the trees, searching diligently, and 20 minutes later his faint shouts drifted up to me. "Ben! Ben! Come here! Quickly!" I dragged myself off the coping of the well and limped down into the valley. "Here it is, Ben!" Laren was wild with excitement, and I was struck again by the power that gold has to quicken the most sluggish pulse, and to put the glitter of avarice in even the most world-weary eye. I am not a materialistic person, but the lure and the magic of it quickened my own breathing as I stood beside Laren and we looked upon the mine of the ancients. It wasn't an impressive sight in itself. A shallow depression, a trench sunk about 3 or 4 feet below the level of the surrounding earth. Its banks gently rounded, it meandered away amongst the trees like a footpath that had been worn into the earth. "Open stope," Laren told me. "They followed the strike of the reef." "And backfilled," I commented on the peculiar habit that the ancients had of filling in all their workings before abandoning them. This shallow trench was caused by the subsidence of the loose soil with which they'd filled it. "Come on," said Laren, "let's follow it." For a mile and a half, we followed the old stope through the forest before it petered out. "If only we could find one of their dumps," Laren muttered as we searched the rank vegetation for a pile of loose rocks, "or at least a piece of the ore that they overlooked." My back was hurting, so I sat on a fallen log to rest and let Laren continue the search. He moved away through the trees, leaving me alone, and I could enjoy the sense of history which enveloped me when I was alone in a place such as this. The water level in the well was 50 feet, so I guessed that this was the depth to which the ancients had worked their stope. They didn't have the pumps or the equipment to evacuate the workings, and as soon as the water started pouring in, they refilled it and left to find another reef. This mine had been an open trench, 1.5 miles long and 50 feet deep by 6 feet wide, hacked from the earth with adzes of iron and iron wedges, pounded into the grain of the rock with stone hammers. When the rock was hard enough to resist this method, then they built fires upon it and poured water mixed with sour wine on the heated surface to shatter it. This was the same method that Hannibal used to break up the boulders that blocked the passage of his elephants across the Alps. A Carthaginian trick, you might call it. From the sheet of reef, they prized lumps of gold quartz and packed it into baskets to be hauled to the surface on rawhide ropes. Using these methods, they removed an estimated 700 tons of fine gold from workings spread over 300,000 square miles of central and southern Africa, together with vast quantities of iron, copper, and tin. That's 22 million ounces of gold at $40 an ounce, $880 million. I worked it out loud, and then added, "And that's a big loaf of bread." "Ben, where are you?" Laren was coming back through the trees. "I found a piece of the reef." He had a lump of rock in his hand, and he handed it to me. "What you make of that?" "Blue sugar quartz," I said, and I licked at it to wet the surface, and then held it to catch the sunlight. "Wow," I exclaimed, as the native gold sparkled wetly back at me, filling the cracks and tiny fissures in the quartz like butter in a sandwich. "Wow, indeed," Laren agreed. "This is good stuff. I'll send a couple of my boys to peg the whole area." "Lo, don't forget about me," I said, and he frowned quickly. "You'll be cut in on it, Ben. Have I ever tried?" "Don't be a clot. I didn't mean that. I just don't want your rock hounds tearing up the countryside before I've had a chance to go over it." "Okay, Ben, okay, I promise," he laughed. "You can be here when we reopen the workings." He juggled the lump of quartz in his hand. "Let's get back. I want to pan this and get some idea of its value." Using one of the stone mortars in the granite cap and a lump of ironstone as a pestle, Laren pounded a piece of the quartz to a fine white powder. This he collected in our cooking pot, and with well water washed off the powdered stone. Swirling the contents of the pot with an easy circular motion, letting a little spill over the rim of the pot with each turn, It took him 15 minutes to separate the tail of gold. It lay curled around the bottom of the pot, greasy, shiny, yellow. "Pretty," I said. "They don't come prettier," Larin grinned. "This stuff will go 5 ounces to the ton." "You're an avaricious bastard, aren't you?" I teased him. "Well, put it this way, Ben," he was still grinning. "The profits from this will probably keep your institute running for another 20 years. Don't kick it, partner. Money isn't the root of all evil if you use it right." "I won't kick it," I promised him. We camped that night beside the well, feasting on boiled elephant tongue and potatoes, and keeping a bonfire going to compensate for our lack of blankets. We spent the following morning cutting out the tusks. These we buried beneath a huge pile of rocks to keep off the hyenas, and it was afternoon before we started back for the Land Rover. Night caught us out again, but we reached the Land Rover in the middle of the following morning. I had blisters on my heels, the size of grapes, and my lumps and bruises ached abominably. I collapsed thankfully into the passenger seat of the Land Rover. Up to this moment, I have never truly appreciated the invention of the internal combustion engine, I announced gravely. "You can now take me home, James." We left Hai and his small tribe to their eternal wanderings in the wilderness, and arrived back at the City of the Moon 8 days after we left it. We were blackened by the sun and an accumulation of dirt. We had sprouted beards, and our hair was stiff with dust and grime. Loren's beard came out a burnished red gold that glistened in the sunlight. He had been AWOL for 3 days, and the pack was clamorous. A tall pile of messages waited for him in the radio shack, and before he could shave or bath, he had to spend an hour on the radio taking care of the most urgent matters that had arisen in his absence. "I should get back to the salt mines right away," he told me as he came out of the shack. "It's 4:30. I could make it." He hesitated a moment, and then his resolve hardened. "No, damn it. I'm going to steal one more night. Get out the Glen Grant while I take a bath." "Now you're talking sense," I laughed. "All the way, partner," he punched my shoulder. "All the way, Lo," I assured him. We talked a lot, sang a little, and drank whiskey until after midnight. "Bed," said Laren then, and rose to go. But suddenly he paused. "Ben, you promised to let me have some photographs of the White King painting to take back with me." "Sure, Lo." I stood up a little unsteadily and went through into the office. I took a sheaf of 9x6 glossy prints from my files and went back with them to Loren. Standing under the light, he shuffled through them. "What's wrong with this one, Ben?" he asked suddenly and handed it to me. "What? I can't see anything." "The face, Ben. There's a mark." I saw it then, a faint shadowy cross which marred the death-white face of the king. I studied it a moment. It puzzled me. I hadn't noticed it before. Like a dark grey hot cross bun. "Oh, it's probably a flaw in the printing, Lo," I guessed. "Is it on the others?" He glanced through the other prints quickly. "No, just that one." I handed it back to him. "No, just a faulty print," I said. "Okay." Laren accepted my explanation. "Good night." I poured myself a nightcap while Sally and the others trooped off after Laren, and I drank it slowly, sitting alone, running over in my mind the plans that Laren and I had formulated for the thorough investigation of the cavern. I will admit that I never gave the mark on the White King's face another thought. My excuse is that I was more than a little drunk. The next 2 months passed swiftly. Ral and I devoted ourselves to a thorough excavation of the floor of the cavern. The results were surprising only in their paucity. The cavern had never been used for human habitation. There was no midden or hearth level. We found an accumulation of animal detritus that extended down to bedrock. On the bedrock itself, we found a single square block of dressed stone, and that was the total bag. Our excavations had given the cavern a forlorn and gutted appearance, and the bedrock was uneven limestone, so I had the dig refilled and neatly levelled. Then we used the ancient blocks to lay a pavement around the emerald pool. I saw this as a concession to the convenience of the thousands of future visitors who would come to view this wonderful gallery of Bushman art once its existence was known to the world. As he had promised, Lauren radioed me when his company was ready to begin the opening of the ancient mine we'd discovered on the hunt for the elephant. A helicopter fetched me, and I spent 3 weeks with the engineers who were doing the work. The reef was there below the water table, as we'd hoped, and although its values varied widely from place to place along its length, yet the average was exceptionally high. Secretly, I was glad of my 10% interest in the mine, despite my non-materialist values. We recovered many hundreds of artifacts, mostly mining tools. There were badly rusted adzes and wedges, stone hammers, scraps of chain, a few well-preserved fiber baskets, and the usual beads and pottery. Of these, I was most pleased with the fiber baskets, which enabled us to obtain a carbon 1-4 date from the laboratories. This was slightly prior to, if not concurrent with, the date of the Great Fire, and served to link the elephant mine with the City of the Moon. However, the most interesting find at the elephant mine was that of 15 human skeletons lying like a string of beads along the stope at its deepest point. The arrangement of the bodies was so regular as to preclude the idea that they may have been killed in a rockfall. Although the skeletons had been flattened by the weight of earth from above, I was able to determine that 5 of them were female and 10 were males. All of them were elderly, and one of them showed traces of arthritis. Another had lost an arm between elbow and wrist, but the bone had insisted, proving that it had not been a recent injury. Most of them had lost teeth. On all of them I found traces of iron chains, and the picture I had was that of 15 elderly and infirm slaves laid deliberately along the bottom of the stope before it was filled. After supervising the cataloguing, packing, and dispatch to the Institute of all these finds, I returned to the City of the Moon, and I went immediately to the cavern. As I'd hoped, Sally was hard at work there. I don't think her pleasure was affected as she came to meet me and kissed me. "Oh, Ben, I've missed you." And then she launched immediately into a technical discussion, and while I made the right answers, my thoughts were far from Bushman paintings. I watched the way she crinkled her nose as she spoke, and the way she kept pushing her hair from her cheek with the back of her hand, and my whole being throbbed with love of her. Down in my stomach I felt a squirming of dread. Our work at the City of Moon was almost finished. Soon we would be returning to Johannesburg and the hushed halls of the Institute. I wondered how this would affect Sally and me. "We'll be leaving soon, Sal," I gave expression to my thoughts. "Yes," she agreed, and immediately sobered. "The thought saddens me. I've been so happy here. I'm going to miss it." We sat in silence for a while, and then Sally stood up and went to stand before the portrait of the White King. She stared at it moodily, her arms folded tightly across her breast. "We've learnt so much here." She paused for a moment and then went on. "And yet there was so much that was denied us. It was like chasing clouds. Often I felt we were so close to having it in our hands." She shook her hands angrily. "There are so many secrets still locked away from us, Ben. Things we'll never know." She turned and came back to where I sat. She knelt in front of me with her hands on her knees, staring into my face. "Do you know, Ben, that we haven't got proof? Do you realize there is nothing we have found here that can't be discredited by the old arguments?" She leaned closer towards me. "We have a symbol on a scrap of pottery, imported in the course of trade, they will say. We have the golden chalice, the work of native goldsmiths using the Ankh motif by chance, they will say. We have the paintings. Hearsay is not evidence, they will say." She sat back on her haunches and stared at me. "Do you know what we have got, Ben, after all it's been sifted and sorted? We've got a big, fat nothing." "I know," I said, miserably. "We haven't even a single fact to knock them off their smug little perch. Our city of the moon, our beautiful city, will be simply another culture of obscure Bantu origin, and there isn't a damn thing we can do about it. We will never know what happened to the great walls and towers, and we will never know where our white king lies buried.